Good morning, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Elizabeth Simpkin. Good morning, Elizabeth. It's good to have you with us.
Good morning, Eric. Thanks.
So we start this out with the question, just who are you? And give us a picture or of qualities or labels or what it is about you as a person we need to know to start this conversation.
Well, of course, that's a huge question.
Yes, it is.
And I asked my son about it yesterday. He said, "You're an earthling." That's definitely true.
And is your son about 10 years old?
He's 12. And I think maybe one of the things that characterizes my life is that I've been sharing my life with the cello ever since I was a small child. And so that is kind of the container for my artistic path, my spiritual path, and my life work.
Uh-huh. Cool. And you brought some music.
I did.
And mm-hmm. Do you want to say a bit about that? Because that's part of your life.
Yeah. Well, so the first thing that I thought maybe we would do, I brought some music of me playing and also some music that I admire a lot. And so Bach is kind of the center point for string players mm-hmm. in a certain way. Mm-hmm. He wrote these 6 suites for solo cello, which I have really been living with and referring to. They're kind of like a touchstone for me. Mm-hmm. And I've been playing them really for, I guess I first started playing them when I was about 11. And so they kind of are really part of my life every day or every week for decades now.
Right.
And so, yeah, I have the most famous one. I thought maybe your listeners would recognize and enjoy the prelude of the G major suite. And this is from a live performance right here in Ithaca.
And here we go. Thank you. And our guest on this hour is Elizabeth Simkin, and that was her performing on the cello, Bach's. Can you give us the full
section? Yes, it's the prelude to the first suite for solo cello by J.S. Bach.
Yes, yes. So, Elizabeth, what experience or experiences have helped to kind of shape the life that you live now? What has helped to bring you to the place you are now? Some of the major ones.
You ask nice and big questions.
Yeah, you can take them, and they're open-ended, and you can take them however you wish, because this is... Yeah.
And I think maybe working backwards
sure.
a little bit.
Yeah.
Definitely, becoming a mother was enormous in my personal and musical path. Moving to Ithaca, being married and divorced,
mm-hmm.
And a Quaker upbringing, and my teachers, and particularly my final teacher, and I would say his death was a very big moment for me just a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he was sort of my dominant mentor. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When did you start working with him?
I started working with him in 1990, and he was the last teacher that I had.
And this was in graduate school?
In graduate school.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
It was 4 years before I moved here.
And you continued to work with him after beyond graduate school informally
we stayed in touch. We stayed in touch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he was a very very influential figure.
Mm-hmm.
For sure.
Mm-hmm. How did his work with you change your relationship with the instrument, or your understanding of what the task was?
Yeah. Well, it's there's a lot of psychology in cultivating the techniques required for classical music, and he was someone who I think at first was a symbol for me of perfection. He was an extraordinary artist,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and his mastery of the instrument was unlike anyone else I had seen. Just a complete physical freedom when he played, complete mastery.
So physical freedom. So he was unselfconscious when he was playing. He was completely moving with the instrument without any kind of sense of pretense.
It was like it was a part of him.
And
so I became fascinated by him as a young adult, and then wanted to go and work with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that my idea was that he was going to give me sort of an impenetrable technique so that I could be invulnerable in the field in a certain way.
Right. He would make you strong.
Yes.
Yes.
And I was feeling very vulnerable, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. very scared about how am I going to make a living doing this thing that I love. And so I went to him, I think, unconsciously wanting a force field.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what I received from him was a real depth of love and belief in more of sort of an inner core that was a big surprise.
Right. Okay. So you didn't so much learn technique as you learned to become human in his presence.
In a certain way, or maybe the beginnings of it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. No. It's funny. I mean, there's a people who experience our valuing them.
Mm-hmm.
Tend to become the value that they feel good about,
mm.
you know, and I mm-hmm. and I've seen that both as a pastor, but also as a person who's worked with people in kind of inner city, very poor neighborhoods, and the people who value their neighbors, even if the neighbors don't look at their lives as being much,
mm-hmm.
they begin to see them of being as great value, and they take care of them in
yes.
ways that are different. So how did you start taking care of yourself in a different way once you began to work with him?
I think I allowed myself to be honest about my limitations. and to not sort of pretend that they weren't there, but to confront them and work with them with confidence that it was possible to change, that change is possible.
And is change overcoming the limitation, or is it finding a way around, or is it a finding a way to live with it that's still beautiful?
All of the above. Yeah. I think it's sort of sitting right in it and working with it and working from it. And then it can move and change.
Right.
Or it can stay the same.
Right. But it assumes the quality of a beauty rather than the quality of an impediment in some ways.
You know, I wouldn't even say beauty or impediment as much as just what's, what's actually there. Yeah.
Yes.
the truth.
Right. Right. Loving what is as opposed to what's not.
Yeah. Yeah. Or just, admit, you know, being with what is, with love and without love.
Being through the emotional spectrum. And that's funny. I don't necessarily mean to jump so quickly there, how does that tie in with your Quaker upbringing?
My Quaker upbringing was more of a sort of an idea than a practice.
Uh-huh.
So my dad, was raised as a Quaker in the Philadelphia area.
Yes, and the home of...
home, yeah.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And then we grew up in Seattle.
Right.
And that was in... We moved there when I was born in 1966. And at that time, he felt that the Quaker meeting was not really feeling comfortable to him. It was the 70s in Seattle. There were a lot of people who were just coming new to Quakerism and just standing up saying whatever they wanted. And he was interested in something more silent and reverent and maybe waiting to speak. So we never went. But he talked to me about it.
Right.
And he answered my questions about what's bigger than who we are, in very simple but satisfying ways throughout my childhood, having to do with a light that we all carry, that light or that divinity being the reason that Quakers can be active, because to hurt or disrespect anyone else's light is hurting and disrespecting ourselves.
Right. And the idea is to be active even as you are very intentional and sometimes slow to act.
Yes.
Slow to react.
Yes.
Yeah.
The Quaker process is a very slow process.
You used a phrase that you something about you heard about, you know, something that your attachment to Quakerism growing up was, there was a word that you used for it that was very, and it struck me in like the way that many people want something and they hear about it and they try to lean into it, but they try too hard.
Oh,
yeah.
That maybe his responses to my questions felt simple and
satisfying. This was earlier where the people really weren't quite living the centeredness of the Quaker tradition. There are lots of people who long for or who have a sense of what a Buddhist tradition or a Christian spiritual tradition might be, or a Quaker tradition, but in their longing they try to grab it rather than to evolve into it, and that makes it more clunky, it makes it more argumentative, it makes it just general. I grew up in the shadow of old men for the most part, born in the 1880s and 90s when I was a little boy. They were old men, and they could sit quietly for the longest time. And this was Protestant piety, largely kind of coming out of a German pietistic background, not a Quaker, not an English background. And they would just size things up, and then they would say something. And they might be in long-standing, decades-old arguments with each other, but they didn't rush them, you know. And there was this quality that, we can all kind of not only coexist, but thrive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I get that feeling that, that he took you out of the kind of combative, argumentative 70s space and created a space for you that was safer and also clearer to experience that tradition.
Yeah, there was a feeling that things don't need to be rushed.
Yeah.
And I really value that. And in this modern age where I'm a very busy working mom,
mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's something that I stray from and return to and continue to hold as an aspiration to be willing to pause.
Mm-hmm.
And
to be kind when you stray.
Yes.
And that's mm-hmm. that's the hardest thing for me is to not get angry, but rather go sad and then go back to kindness.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In my effort to rush along with life.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And we have to keep up.
Yeah. I hear all sorts of tones in your voice when you say that.
Yeah.
Yeah. that's great. That's great. So coming back, you talked through a number of things, talking your way back, becoming a mother, divorcing. How has your life become more like a piece of art? Which is how I kind of experience you talking about it as you have come into these more recent 5 years or 10 mm-hmm. years.
Yeah, well, I think that so becoming a mom definitely was just, you know, it was sort of wonderful to experience the heart kind of exploding
mm-hmm.
Realigning everything that I valued, and that so that just sort of surprised me. It was almost like it was a chemical thing.
Right, right. And you used an interesting metaphor. It didn't transform. It didn't replace. It realigned mm-hmm. everything you value. And what do you mean by that?
Well, I think you know particularly where does music go. You know,
uh-huh. Where does music go after you have the voice of a child in your ear?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And I think, what is the purpose of music? What is the meaning of music? And I developed a whole new relationship with music, through lullaby singing.
Oh, really?
Which was just a huge part of my son is now 12, and his early life was pretty much continuous singing,
mm-hmm,
and it was wonderful for me because my singing is very imperfect, and my cello playing is rather refined,
mm-hmm.
And so having that experience of the singing working every time. And really knowing this is not because I'm really good. Uh-huh. This is because it's nothing but love.
Right. So the working was it comforted him or it
yes.
it did what it was called. Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
It put him to sleep.
Yeah.
It stopped him crying. Mm-hmm. It it just was the magic touch
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
along with going outside. Those were the yeah. two key things that whenever I, you know, then I'm talking about babyhood mostly,
right, right,
but,
yeah.
You know, going outside and singing would always take care of distress. And so I started sort of chasing after now, how can I have that kind of intimacy, that kind of, exposure in my cello playing that, that I have in my singing where, you know, it might be 3 a.m. and my voice is croaking and shaking and,
you've just woken up to,
and it works.
Yeah.
He's out like a light in, yeah. you know, one phrase.
So how is that knowledge of the love that comes through the music? How is that changing your performance?
Yeah, partly it's hard to explain.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely comes in a kind of mysterious way, but also there is some, I don't know, maybe, well, I mean, one thing that I've done consciously is to play for people at the bedside in order to just see what it feels like to play to one person instead of a crowd.
Right.
And
so at the bedside in at home, in a hospice?
Or in the Cougar Medical or in hospice.
Okay.
I did quite a bit of that on my sabbatic a couple of years ago.
Uh-huh.
And
What did you discover?
Well, that the two most common responses are tears and sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And that music is really powerful. And that I would usually start off with Bach, just because it's so kind of home base for me, and I could really bring my attention to the listener, mm-hmm, the family, mm-hmm, and the person who is ill. I usually ended up doing something much more simple and much more spare, and often by the end of a session, I would also be singing.
Mm-hmm. Accompanying yourself.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of a combination, I guess, of my cultivated cello playing and my comforting cello playing.
Mm-hmm. Would this be a good time to cut to Stevie Wonder?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I've been very... this is one of my favorite albums from childhood. I did grow up in a... the public schools that I went to were very, very interracial. And I was a huge Stevie Wonder fan as a kid. And I've been really struggling with... the murders that are happening. And I have been having this Stevie Wonder song kind of percolating for a couple of years now, actually. I just feel like I can't get it out of my head. So this is Love's in Need of Love Today by Stevie Wonder.
Good evening, friends. Here's your friendly announcer. I have serious news to pass on to everybody. What I'm about to say could mean the world's disaster. Could change your joy and laughter to tears and pain. It's that love in need of love today. Don't delay, send yours in right away. Then you'll hear me when I say,
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And that was Stevie Wonder and the song Love's in Need of Love Today. And our guest on this hour is Elizabeth Simpkin. So, Elizabeth, you talked about growing up in Seattle and in a time of racial tension and mentioned while we were listening to the song that there was kind of a numbness that you had for that for many years. Can you say a bit about that? And can we head and I think and what and how you come back to that now in these times?
Well, you know that there's a lot of unrest up at Ithaca College where I work right now, in terms of racism and bias that are sort of deeply part of the culture.
Mm-hmm, sure.
I think of higher education in general, and
within music, and it's such a and within music faculty specifically too, because I've heard that that's a historic issue.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so this, the Black Lives Matter movement, I think, has really been having wonderful trickling out effects, and really bringing very deep and rich questions to places that have just been not necessarily very awake, mm-hmm, or very thoughtful. And from the time of that song, actually, in the 70s, I had a kind of a wonderful opportunity when I was young, because I was a fairly serious basketball player.
Uh-huh.
And it happened that in my freshman year of high school, I was the only white girl on the JV team. And it started off, I was quite intimidated, in that. And then over the course of my continuing to show up and kind of do my best, even though I would say I was probably about the worst one on the team. I felt a shift from suspicion of me to a great amount of love and protection for me.
On the part of your other teammates?
From my teammates.
Wow.
Yeah. And in fact, it's probably worth sharing a story. We were playing a team that was almost all Native American, and our team was almost all African American. And after the game, we were in the locker room, and the Native American team was teasing me. That white girl sat bench. And it was true, I had hardly played for the whole game.
Yeah.
And my teammates stood in a line like a wall in front of me. And they my nickname was Baby. Uh-huh. And they said, "You got something to say to Baby, you tell it to us." And they stood there in front of me with this force and willingness to fight, which I never felt about anything. And I was scared that we might have a fight, and we didn't. But it was just a really powerful moment for me of sort of an introduction to a fierce kind of a love.
Right.
That was not part of my way.
Right.
Not part of my experience. And so I sort of have a little bit of an imprint from that.
Mm-hmm,
and then, of course, you know, being in conservatory, it just, I didn't think about it for a long time.
Right. When, I mean, it's doubly distant for you. White middle-class folks don't understand force.
Mm-hmm.
Quakers are, the force is the last thing in the world.
Yes.
Quakers want to be close to on a certain level. But what you described in that face-to-face lineup is, we acknowledge your force and we meet it, but we do not exceed it.
Mm.
And knowing how to use force, which is what poor people need to do and what persons of color need to do, mm-hmm. and it's oftentimes misread by persons of privilege who never have to go there.
That's
because
right.
Because they verbally negotiate or intellectually negotiate.
That's
they
right.
never have to use their bodies as communication tools
yes.
or their emotions with that kind of subtlety, so they don't know how to do it.
That's right.
And that's,
And the people of color at IC who are right now holding these extremely powerful demonstrations, there can be a mean edge, which I really struggle with.
Yeah.
But at the same time, what I'm learning is that this is what's required to feel heard.
Yes, and I want to unpack that in a couple of different ways, and you can stop me if I'm taking it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes you have to get to provoke yourself when you're an outsider to action. You have to build up esteem ahead of anger rather than the truest emotion, because the anger gets you over your own internal resistance to speaking up. And then when people hear you speak, they experience the edge.
Mm-hmm.
And the anger, but they don't realize that that was merely a tool to give you a voice in an environment that systematically shuts it down.
That's right.
I came to Cornell from poverty. I had more in common with the house cleaners in 1976 than I did with the cleaning staff, than I did with the faculty or the students. And I, you know, partly I am a pushy kind of guy at times, mm-hmm. but that's, you know, in a culture where people, you know, they just push back, and, you know, it's part mm-hmm. of the repartee. It's not experienced as brutish or as edgy,
mm-hmm.
but it is for people who, even people of color of privilege, who've in a certain sense gotten past it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? But also for white folks. Middle-class white folks, it's very uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's very uncomfortable. Sure. And but what's very clear is it's time to listen and feel.
Right. And to maybe, if you can be kind to people who have to get angry to speak, and just acknowledge, I know the courage that has taken, and
yes.
frame it as courage rather than anger.
There's so much courage.
It will help to soften
yes.
the experience.
Yeah, the courage.
Without taking the honesty away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, we've got this group of students who are occupying the administrative building. Right now they're sleeping there.
Mm-hmm.
And it does require so much courage. And that's what I feel, even as the targeting, you know, it might be the words are presenting an oversimplification of the problem, but it just feels so right that somebody is yelling no.
Right, right. And the response, in order for it to be real, almost has to be quicker, in the sense that it has to be slow and the long haul.
Mm.
Because to respond too quickly, to try to address it too quickly, to try to resolve it too quickly, means it'll never be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And to just say, well, this is the first piece of the first movement of a much larger piece that will take decades
mm-hmm.
to play out. And we don't tend to look at it in those kinds of time horizons, because we want to address it now, but we just have to honor what's being challenged and respond to it and say, we can't fix what has gone wrong in 300, 200 years
mm-hmm.
in a year.
Mm-hmm.
But we can begin to honestly address it and try to protect a space where it will be addressed. You know?
And, yeah, and to share
I'm
that.
I'm preaching.
Well, but I think it's a very, very huge thing, because there's so much feeling coming up around it. And
mm-hmm.
And it's kind of bringing us face to face with our own programming,
mm-hmm.
our own blindnesses,
right?
And it's kind of brought me back in touch with what it felt like way back there on the basketball team,
right? And what have you seen now that you weren't seeing a year ago?
I think that. There was a tipping point for me, just on a very personal level, on in the heart, with the Michael Brown verdict.
Mm-hmm.
That I think maybe before that decision came out, I had a head orientation that, oh God, this is terrible. And when that verdict came out, it was a complete surprise to me. But I was teaching, and one of my students walked in, who happens to be African American, and it just flooded me, in a way that had nothing to do with thought, that this could have been him.
Mm-hmm.
This could have been him. And, and so it was, and I just started apologizing. You know, I guess I didn't feel anymore like, yeah, that's terrible and it doesn't have anything to do with me. And not that I'm going to take it on as my fault, but I felt an understanding that I need to participate in unpacking my part, everybody's part, in this depth of distance that we've come to.
In your story, what I hear is you were grieving the issue rather than judging the issue.
I was grieving it, yes.
And in that grief, you could empathize with your student in a way you hadn't done before.
Yes.
The apology is not an apology for fact. It's an acceptance of the deep, unfair sadness of it all.
Yes. And it finally came into my body when this person, who in many ways I love like a son,
mm-hmm.
Brought it home.
Yep.
He didn't say a word, but something was brought home, yeah, so that a lot of grief started pouring out for I mean, I think in a lot of ways, I like that image of the, if you throw a frog in boiling water, it'll jump out. But if it is slowly, the temperature is rising, it will be killed. Mm-hmm. And I think that on so many levels in our world today, the temperature is slowly rising. And that was a moment for me where I think what's very obvious, it's like the elephant in the room that none of us is able to see. We've got to jump out of here.
Right. And what's complicating right now is when people have a legitimate reason to have fear, they tend to allow themselves any sort of reaction as justifiable if I'm afraid. Mm. And somebody else needs to fix it so I won't be afraid, rather than learning how to manage our fears ourselves, which is a lot of the hatred and the venom towards Muslims and the venom towards, you know, people who are, quote, not like whatever the standard is. Mm. We haven't learned how to sit with our own reactions to our own fear or grief.
Mm-hmm.
And we're stuck. How has this awareness changed your teaching? Or, I mean, you're in the middle of it. So what do you feel changing between the story with your student and the story about going to the bedside where music is love?
Right.
How is this changing the way you are as a mentor, as a teacher?
I think that it's an interesting thing. You know, as I was coming up in my training, I never questioned my teachers, and at least on the surface, it didn't seem that they particularly questioned themselves. You know, that wasn't part
of it. You were unaware
of
it, at least.
I was unaware of it,
right. And you may have been unaware of it in yourself. I mean, but yeah.
Sure.
But
I mean, of course, they must have questioned themselves, but the feeling tone was, that's the expert, and I'm the learner. And I think that part of bringing the instrumental training into this new time is being wide open about, go ahead and question me and know that I'm questioning myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been at this for longer than you and have a lot to offer.
Right. And this is, you're raising a really interesting issue. Power is not always privilege. Power just has been there before and done it and has some mastery and some skill. And yet, if persons in positions of power don't show the way in which they have their skill and their knowledge is just kind of a work in progress, then they have kind of maintained the curtain with the Wizard of Oz, you know, rather than opened the curtain and said, this is what we're doing here.
This is what's real.
Yeah. And this is how we're working very hard to make things. And I can speak with great confidence, but I also speak with great humility.
Mm.
And that people in power don't often know how to mentor people in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think it would be a beautiful new way.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. Part of it is getting past some of the slogans and also really having skin in the game, and it's scary.
Yeah.
And we would be much better dealing with the fear and the bluster now if we had practiced this for 50 or 100 years and we're not, but maybe. And this has always been a minority style. You know what I mean? In terms of, you know, dominant culture is dominant because it doesn't question itself, you know? And so that puts those of us who wish to see this in a different light on a path that will keep us somewhat at odds.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And the elitism and privilege in the culture of Western classical music is, I mean, it's just unquestionable. And yet, the music is pretty amazing.
The music is amazing when one embodies it, as you said near the beginning. part of my resistance to classical music is what captured my soul were the lute fantasias from the 15th century, mm-hmm. Because they were pieces with abandon and tremendous mm-hmm. interesting structures and improvisation all at the mm-hmm. same time, but most of it required a level of discipline and appreciation that I couldn't give to it. I grew up, we sang while we worked. So we learned to value the rough singing that mm-hmm. you learned when you were singing lullabies to your or songs to your son as mm-hmm. an infant. We did that while we worked on the farm. Mm-hmm. And that's a very traditional way of owning music and letting it come out of your life. But someday I think I will have more of this capacity to relate to classical music as the giving over into the beauty. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's because I see it in you, and I've seen it in many other people. It's kind of my own classism from the bottom up. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Which mm-hmm. is my own prejudice, and I own it to some extent. What should we go to next musically before we enter our last segment of conversation?
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan. One of the things that I brought was Hank Roberts, who is one of my local heroes, and I like his song "Peaceful Mind," where he's kind of talking a lot about humility and economy and peace and love. And yeah, he's been quite a good friend here in Ithaca.
And this piece is called Peaceful Mind?
Peaceful Mind, okay, yep. And it's Hank Roberts and Wiggy Dog Boy.
What a name.
From the clouds, that kind of dollar bill sure make a happy crowd. I wish that Martin was still alive. If we can't have that, I'll take him on a five. Hamilton, well, it's always men. I see the mother of us all on a rainbow tin. Do you suppose that Black Elk was suspicious of money? If we spread it out, I could see him on a 20. I could see him on a 20. Thank you.
You're listening to the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Elizabeth Simpkin. So, Elizabeth, the question that I like to end the show with is, what do you do? How do you take care of yourself? How do you restore yourself physically, emotionally, intellectually, daily, weekly, monthly? You know, mm-hmm. How do you do that, and when do you know you need to do that?
Well, I tend to need to do it at the end of every semester. Uh-huh. Yeah, get much more compressed. I do have a daily meditation practice, which is quite nourishing.
Silent meditation or reading meditation?
I do it with a couple of my friends in my neighborhood, mm-hmm. and we often listen to guided meditation from sure. a teacher that we enjoy named Adi Ashanti, mm-hmm. Or we do a silent meditation. And so that's a daily thing. And then I have a dog, and I walk her in nature for 2 to 4 miles a day.
That's good.
And that is very helpful. Mm-hmm. It's extremely helpful because she just requires getting out there. And then musically, I have been very, very slowly expanding from the canon of the classical tradition. And one of my big inspirations is a dear friend of mine, my colleague at Ithaca College, Nicholas Walker. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a piece which we played. This is from a concert in June where he's actually pushed me to do a fair amount of improvisation and also being part of the creative process in some of the pieces that he's written. We had a duo project that we've done quite a bit. And this piece is very lively. I thought it might be nice for Sunday morning. It's in 7, which has a kind of a fun groove, almost a Balkan feel. Yeah. and it's a little bit, derivative of our time, maybe a little bit more.
Sure.
And it's called Watermark, and it's been a pleasure to be here.
Elizabeth, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
You too.
Here we go.